two different ones of those?
Yes.
Right. Mr. Hermans, where are you? No, which one of the two? Or do you want to have the rolling down? Can you please introduce yourselves?
Good morning, afternoon, Chairperson, and to the honourable members. My name is Bongile Khumalo, the Chairperson of the Board of the South African Wizard Christ Organization, and I'm here with our CEO, Ms. Nothando Mikoko. We have two other colleagues, a board member and our legal manager and Sangro. I'm here with these colleagues. We welcome the amendment of the Copyright Act. For instance, the need to improve it, the need to add issues on the Copyright Act that are going to make it that are going to make the act more easily to protect the rights of the creators, of music, the creators of literary works, and so on. We, for instance, welcome the introduction of what is called the Communication to the Public Right Amendment. For instance, we do not oppose the regulations that will make sure that the regulations within or of the Act are stringently observed. We, however, advise and request very strongly that we need close engagement with the drafters of the regulations to ensure that they are aware of the manner in which the industry works in practice, and that there's an understanding of our challenges, which are caused both by legislation as it exists and within the industry as a whole. Certainly, we would have wanted and expected the bill to have more focus on strengthening of statutory or legal copyright compliance. If a broadcaster or a digital site entity does not pay, for an example, we need to be able to enforce or have a mechanism that will enforce that payment. Otherwise, there is no point, as we see it at any rate, to having an amendment to a copyright that takes us to pre-1994 as we understand it. Thirdly, we do not have regulations on the private copy levy. They just do not exist. And the industry has been asking for years for the lawmakers to introduce a private copy levy so that we had hoped that they would take the opportunity in this bill to do so. But nothing has happened. So the private copy levy means every importer or manufacturer of a device that is capable of making copies of music or film, etc., pays a levy that benefits the creative industry. Ms. Mikoko will talk to the question of the fair use issue. The only thing as a creator that I would like to point out is that what we understand is that users getting or given more benefits happens at the expense of creators, and we feel that is not fair. It's called a fair use. It's called fair use, but it is actually not fair. IP, lastly, I'd like to just point out that IP, as we understand it, as has been entrenched in our Bill of Rights, is a property right, and this has been referred to. As creators of music and of literary works, we feel that our rights as property owners, because intellectual property is an ownership of property, that is not talking to, or protecting rather, our rights as property owners, and that needs to happen. We appeal, we encourage, we need to do whatever needs to be done to ensure that that property right is protected. And so I'd like to ask Ms. Mikoko to play a very short video and hope that the honorable members will hear from the creators of music itself, because those are the people that are going to be impacted by this amendment.
I'm sure most of the speakers before myself have alluded, and I know that the previous speaker also spoke about the delicate balance that is copyright. And I think just in terms of setting the context of the discussion or of my presentation, I would like us to just really bear in mind or keep in mind this concept of copyright being a balance of two aspects. So one is the creator's rights, and the other being the user's interest. And I would like also just to emphasize the slightly different wording in that the creator's rights, those are the author's rights, the composer's rights, and the user's interest. I know that there's reference to user's rights, but I've always learned that in this space, it's actually user's interest, the interest of the user to access the copyright, not the right of the user. So what keeps this balance together, or keeps the scale in balance? On the one side, from a user's access perspective, obviously we've got, like I said, the public interest to access, and you've got permission and remuneration-based access policies, framework, legal frameworks, etc. And on the copyright side of things, you have the right to a creator's fruits of his labor, his or her own labor, and the right to reward that creator. I've heard rhetoric to the effect that, you know, well, creators do it for the love, you know, they create for the love because they love it, their passion. That's true, but that has nothing to do with the fact that they have the right to the fruits of their labor. To keep the balance together, we need the correct legal infrastructure. From a creator's rights perspective, we need supportive legislation that protects rights and obliges users to acknowledge, remunerate, and respect that copyright. This is also based on constitutional principles. The fact that property is a right, it is held, it is owned, and any expropriation of that property has to be on the basis of remuneration. On the user's access side, you also obviously need enabling legislation that gives clear and fair guidance on how access is supposed to happen, access to the creative works produced. As I said, I just want to also make reference to the fact that the current bill that we're discussing today is the fruit of a consultative framework, an IP consultative framework document that was produced. And as part of the discussion around that IP consultative framework, which also gave birth to the interministerial committee looking at the rights of creators, the purpose of the drafters of that policy were looking at ways to strengthen creators' rights to improve quality of life. It was obviously also in response to long-held views in the media, in society, that musicians, artists, composers are not, firstly, are dying paupers. Secondly, are not being protected. They're not, you know, by labor legislation, by other types of legislation. So we needed to create, within our existing legal infrastructure, a framework that actually manages to protect our composers and authors and creators in general a lot more. We, however, feel quite that the Copyright Amendment Bill tips the scale and actually creates an imbalance in this copyright legislation. This is done by users' access, the interest, public interest to users' access being given more weight than creators' rights or copyright is given, and it's actually at the expense of copyright. So? How is this imbalance actually created? Excuse me. So if we take a look back at what I was saying that the IP consultative framework was trying to achieve, the bill fails to a large extent to deal with lack of compliance in the industry. Now, everyone in the industry, from a practical perspective, will tell you that over the last, in fact, for years, decades, part of the biggest problem in terms of how collecting societies work is the ability for us to enforce reporting compliance and payment compliance from our users. If broadcasters, you know, major users of music do not report correctly, there's no way that a collection society is going to function as accurately and as efficiently as it's supposed to be, because we rely on data given by the users. And it was this very reason that we really expected, in fact, we were happily anticipating that this bill is going to, for example, bring in statutory measures, statutory compliance, to say that if a major a TV broadcaster, radio broadcaster is simply not reporting what they're playing, we can look to the Act to say, okay, but the Act says this is an offense in terms of this section, so you are now obliged to report in that way. The Act is conspicuous, I mean the bill rather is conspicuously silent on giving us really the strong statutory support that we needed. And it then of course introduces the concept of fair use without safeguards. I will talk about fair use just now in a bit, just to really give our view and our perspective of why we feel that this is such a, if you really look at it, a very dangerous route for us to take, given our very specific context and historical and current context in South Africa. The bill also introduces expropriation of intellectual property without compensation. I will also discuss that a bit further. And here I'm talking about specifically where in the current dispensation, the current Act, authors and composers and artists are guaranteed copyright in certain instances. This bill, without any mention of compensation, as would be required by Section 25 of the Constitution, now takes away this copyright, takes away this intellectual property, and does not even talk about any additional compensation. But I will get into that a bit later. And by bringing in the concept of fair use into our law, it introduces a cumbersome process for creators to protect their copyright. Just to give you a background on who Samra is, and it's unfortunate that our video was not able to be played, because it gave a very good background as to who we represent. Yes, Samra is an organization, it's a non-profit corporation, but we have 15,000 members, full members. The majority of those members are between the ages of 15 and 35. That's 4,467 members that are within that age group. So the bulk of individual composers that are represented by SAMRO are people in their youth, people who can hardly afford to go to court for anything because of the financial constraints. If we bear in mind the fact that to go to court, it's a minimum of around 250,000 rand, and that's first round, you know, to really fully comply, I mean, to defend a copyright infringement matter. So with regards to fair use and why I'm bringing about these statistics and why they're relevant, fair use is obviously a concept that, like our current concept of fair dealing, tries to deal with the one side of the scale to say, how do we ensure that the public interest to accessing copyright-protected works works? How do we ensure that that interest is catered for and catered to? The main difference, I think, that we need to bear in mind is that fair use is, as compared to fair dealing, fair use is open-ended. It essentially says, yes, even though it has got four guiding factors, that as a user, you can use copyright-protected work as long as, bearing in mind these four factors, a court will find your use to have been fair. So it brings a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of uncertainty from a creative perspective, whereas now we know that we've got five very specific instances where my work as a creator can be used by a user, and I know that in those instances I will not be remunerated. Fair use opens up a very large, you know, an open-ended, we just don't know what will fall into fair use. Because it's highly driven by litigation, it's highly driven by the court, that's where we find definition as to, is this fair use, is it not? So it comes from the US as a concept. A US, as we know, is a very litigious society, and their I would assume, of course, then that you would go to court, your case would be heard quickly, and you will find out what the outcomes are soon. In South Africa, if you approach the court, it's anything 18 to 24 months before you're heard. And we know this even as organizations, we look to see if we can go to court. It's just very difficult. And these are now individual composers aged 15 to 35, being the majority of our members, who'd be forced to go to court to try and find justice for their youth. The fact that we've got a slow court system affects the general population is not, in our opinion, a reason to say, oh, well, so now it will just put creators in the exact same situation. In fact, we need to be moving, even if we're doing it one segment of society at a time, to remove members of society from the vulnerable position where they have to rely to the courts until we know that our court system is working better. Also in the US, we know that the freedom of expression right trumps a lot of other rights. They've got quite a different approach constitutionally to the right to freedom of expression. Where in South Africa, no right is absolute. And we know that we've got the Section 36 limitation clause in the Constitution and the property clause itself, which the intellectual property framework specifically defines intellectual property as property as defined by the Constitution. You cannot just expropriate property without compensation. That's how it works. And with the clause that is brought in by this bill, where there's an automatic expropriation of copyrights in commissioned works, this is exactly what is happening, expropriation of rights without compensation. The current situation is if a TV series commissions you as a composer to write the opening sequence, the music for the opening sequence of the TV series, every time that TV series plays, whether it's the opening to Mubango, the opening to Generations, the opening to Sia van der Laan, every time that song, every time that program plays, there are copyright is earned on those on that play, on the public performance of that play. The bill now says that once Mubango commissions you to write that song, Mubango or the SABC or whoever, MultiChoice or ETV now owns the copyright in that work. So every time that sequence plays, those royalties that used to go to you as the author now go to the broadcaster or whoever it is that who commissioned you. We're not talking about small monies here. SAMRO currently pays between 80 and 90 million rand a year out to commissioned writers for this very type of rights. If this bill goes through, this clause 3 is accepted as is, it means that 80 to 90 million rand that was previously on an annual basis going into the hands of commissioned writers will now be re-diverted to the commissioner who, I mean, right now is supposed to be the broadcaster.
I need you to know that I've given extra time. This has been going for 35 minutes. I've taken 10 minutes off because of the disruption. But you do need to wind up now. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. I'm on my last slide. The last point I'd like to address is the regulation of collecting societies that is in the bill. We do, in principle, as my chair says, we agree and accept the principle of regulation because we feel we are committed to the objective of improving the lives of creators. So insofar as the regulation of collecting societies brings us closer to that goal, we are absolutely in for that. And that means making sure that we are accountable for how and when we pay our royalties. We do, however, request intense engagement on the regulations by the legislators so that they understand our day-to-day practicalities of how what we deal with when collecting royalties. We would hope for an upfront agreement of reporting requirements so we know on an annual basis this is what we have to prepare, we have to submit this kind of audited document, etc. That is what we are hoping for. And we still, on the final note, we do feel that collecting societies are best placed to deal with the issue of orphan works. And those are works where the owners cannot be found. The real thing that needs to happen here is that the legislative framework needs to enforce accurate reporting, because most of the time when we have works that cannot be paid out, it's because we get 100 rand from a broadcaster, but they only report for 60 rand. So there's 40 rand sitting there, we don't know whose it is. So what we actually need is for the legislation to support us in that sense in being able to identify those people. But we've got the mechanism, but we're very happy, and we are actually quite looking forward to working with the regulators in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Magogo, and also the chairman, Dr. Kamala. Yes. And Ms. Moore, where's Ms. Moore?
Ms. Moore's over there.
And Mr. Thomas. Thomas. All right. I don't know where this name comes from, but it's given to me as part of FUMRO as the Group Chief Supply Chain Officer. And FUMRO never heard of it. All right, let's leave that one and ask the staff to review their notes. Thank you very much. Can we immediately go on to Delro? We'll be asking questions after the three of you. Delro is the Dramatic, Artistic and Literary Rights Organization. All right, can we do the changeover in 2 minutes? Members, while we're waiting for that changeover to take place, let's just, Shakespeare said, lend me your ears. I really need them. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to work Thursday night. Not until 12. We're going to work until 8 o'clock on Thursday night. We will organize transport, all right, if there aren't buses. Whatever, because it would certainly appear as if the time allocated was not sufficient. Do you agree? Do you agree? I don't know. No one agrees. Okay. The time allocated to different presentations, because two of them have run short. We've had a technical problem on the last one, as you know, and you lose 10 minutes. And to lose 10 minutes all the time begins to add up, you see. And remember, when the house starts, we don't have this opportunity. That's what worries me. Whenever the house is sitting and there's three line whips, it's more challenging than it is this week. So I hope that having you gave me your ears, you've heard what I've had to say. Is there any comments?
I have a domestic engagement at 7, and I would not want to put that at risk.
Yes, I also have one, but I'll put it at
is that removing from us? Do we work on Friday then?
We will have to work on Friday. The last time we spent many more hours on the copyright bill. It is a complex bill. It truly is. And even those of us who come with that experience are finding it challenging, let alone people and legislators working on it for the first time. And the pressures in Parliament are of such a nature, as you know yourself, Honourable Mantas, that when the House is sitting, it's very challenging. You sit then until 10, which is much more difficult. All right. That's all I'm saying. I don't think any one of us want to use Saturday, and that's the other option I have been given. So let us rather work within the week. All right? That's what I'm requesting. We've got a long week already, Friday. We're working till Friday. And I will be here on Thursday, for those who are wondering. Right, thank you. Do you require any music or TV or whatever? No. Okay, can you stop? Delro, you have got Mr. Sarobi, Managing Director, Ms. Mwebi.
Mwebi.
And Mr. Myberg. And Ms. Van Tonder. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair.
You first heard this morning from the solo act, then you got a duet, and now you got a quartet to entertain you. Thanks for the opportunity to the chair and the committee for allowing us to come and make this presentation. I first want to apologize for the incorrect document that was sent earlier. It has been corrected, and I hope everyone has now got the proper one in front of them. As Professor Kajeka said earlier, I studied law and not science. So I'm first going, you've heard earlier from Dr. Kumalo, who's a music creator, and before I even go any further, I'd like for you to hear from a literary creator, Ms. Mukwebi, who will talk to the committee first.
The chairman of the portfolio committee, Mejuan Fab, member of the portfolio committee, officials from the Department of Trade and Industry, colleagues in the copyright industry and guests. My name is Shamin Kulwani Mukwebi. I'm a self-published author, a content producer of children's educational books and programs. I'm born and bred in Kabancho, a small town in the Free State. It is in the province that I work full-time promoting literacy and telling stories of our beautiful African heritage. In partnership with other self-published authors, our quest is to transform non-readers into readers and to instill in them the love of books, thereby creating a culture of buying and paying for our books. Growing up in Kabancho, we had just one library which I visited daily. The library became a home for me, and it allowed me to explore the world in its various forms and to learn about opportunities and alternatives. I read and met amazing creators in texts that I read. They healed and inspired me, as I hope to one day also write and become a healer through words. As fate would have it, 9 years ago when I got my first job, it was in the library environment, where I enjoyed blissful world of privilege, reading, recommending reading materials. I had it all. I was what you would call a teacher, lecturer, information teacher. I was at the receiving end of any form of information available and accessible in South Africa and other countries. Amidst all the privilege, I saw a gap of information that was not available in printed form in our libraries, nor available in any form. There was an unmet need. Learners and users will come in daily needing information on African literature, African customs, and African stories. Constituted about 2%, all that existed constituted only 2% of that information. In 2014, as a mother of two children, a breadwinner of my family, young sisters, and extended family of cousins, I decided to resign from my job in the library environment and become a full-time author. I chose literature and I chose to become a full-time author and publisher. My aim was to write books, sell them, and feed myself and my extended family. I did that despite the unfortunate history of African literary authors who seem to be doomed to the life of struggling and dying poor without recognition for their work. Names of Solplaki, Bessie Head, and world-class great authors such as Louis Nkosi, who were cheated, come to mind. I still chose books to feed me. I had a plan. I would write books that would fill the gap. My books would be bought by libraries, by households, and from these books I sold, I would pay for my children's school fees, pay for my cousin's learner's license, and get my grandmother the operation she long needed. The vision was simple: get as many people as possible to buy my books and make profit while creating a literature that would give Africans their identity. While I do not regret the decision, I live with the daily reality that I may never be able to sustain my family and out of a major income as a writer. I have to constantly hustle to create and sustain the lifestyle that my children and I deserve. Even more importantly, and the reason I'm here today, is that unless you honorable members of the parliament intervene and make sure that the bill is improved to eliminate some of its critical flaws, the situation for me and my fellow authors and creators of copyright works will deteriorate. The aims of the bill. The Copyright Act amended bill that is before Parliament is part of a series of actions by the government, mainly through the Department of Trade and Industry, to reform the intellectual property laws and landscape in South Africa. The two main reasons to initiate such reforms were, one, to modernize and adapt the IP laws to the internet era, two, to address the concern expressed and demand made by creators of copyright works of, who are authors of literary and dramatic works, visual artists, composers of music works, and performers in sound recording. Our demands related to the extent to which we are able or unable to share in the financial benefits derived from the use of our works. The bill in its current form significantly fails to meet these two goals. The bill fails to meet its stated goals. One, the bill fails to achieve the goal of aligning and upgrading the Copyright Act to the internet era in a number of ways. The bill's introduction of the communication to the public right is not complete in that it's not granted for all copyright works. B, the offensive section does not introduce consequential changes. There are no remedies like site blocking that are suited to enforcement of the internet. Indeed, the bill takes enforcement rights away, specifically the right of the copyright owner to act against trading in infringing copies. Two, the bill also fails to meet the demands and expectations of creators, as expressed to the President of the Republic of South Africa in his consultation with creative industries in 2009. It thereby fails to fulfill the government's promise to resolve these problems. At the heart of the creators' concern was the inability to make a living from the use of their work. The overall net effect of the bill is that it leaves creators worse off than in the current situation. At best, it dilutes the copyright-based income stream of the creators, and in other words, it threatens to eliminate income streams currently derived from certain users. The major negatives with regard to the bill as it relates to the authors of literary and dramatic works. One, the introduction of gamut of expression, which allows for use of copyright works without compensation and even without a requirement to get permission from the copyright owner. Of great concern is the exception relating to copyright use for educational purposes. While the need to create greater access is undeniable, such access must not be created at the expense of their right holder. There are currently effective mechanisms to facilitate access and to ensure that the author is compensated. While this licensing arrangement can be made more efficient, introducing exceptions for educational institutions like pulling the rug from under the author's feet. The introduction of internationally unaccepted user rights is significantly problematic. This effective makes the user a co-owner of copyright in the work they did not create, but need or want to use. Besides diluting the income to be received by the creator, this new right takes away the moral right of the creator. Moral rights are the cornerstone of copyright ownership. This can be compared to giving a large supermarket chain a sectional title deed to a producer's farm, simply because the chain needs to sell the farmer's produce. The bill goes too far in broadening copyright ownership by the government and organization that commission or finds the creation of copyright works. What the bill proposes is the bill goes too far in broadening copyright ownership by the government and organization that commissions or funds the creation of copyright works. The bill provides that the copyright in works made by or under the direction or control of the state or an international organization shall, if such work are eligible for copyright, belong to the state or such an international organization. This effectively means that existing copyright exception of giving ownership of the product of commissioned works by the state to the state will now be widened to include the works of authors and other creators who earn a living through the royalties earned on a literary and musical works commissioned by, amongst others, television broadcasters. Important additional recommendation. In addition to addressing the shortcomings discussed above, it is important that the Parliament, through the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, considers the following recommendations. 1. Ensure that the South African government accedes to the WIPO Internet Treaties, or alternately ensure that the relevant principles in those are correct and consistently incorporated. 2. In addition to introducing the artist's resale rights, introduce the public learning rights and the copyright levy. Don't adopt the legislation that overrides contractual terms which are fair where there is no demonstrable need. It is in fact to be encouraged that greater access to copyright is to be facilitated through mutually beneficial contracts or agreement. In conclusion, Madam Chairman, thank you for the opportunity you have accorded me and my colleagues to present to this committee of honorable members. It is my sincere hope that this exercise is not just meant to go through the motions, but to indeed engage and give serious consideration to the input made. At the end of the day, I urge you to judge all inputs against a simple criterion. In what state will the bill which we send to Parliament and to the President for approval and signing into law leave the most vulnerable in a copyright chain, the creator? Will we be worse off or better off? Let us not kill the soul of African authors.
Thanks very much. I didn't get the pronunciation.
Mukwebi.
Thanks, Chair. I'll go straight into what DARO is, what we do, and what our position is as an organization to the bill. Then Mr. Maybeck will then talk to the legal the legality of it all, and the copyright, the legal aspects, and all of us, including Ms. Fontana, will be available for questions or discussions later. I will try not to repeat what Ms. Mukwebe has already said, because I think there's a few common aspects that we want to go through, but for time's sake, we'll try and not to repeat that. DARO is an organization, is an agency that licenses the use of literary works and dramatic works, generally speaking, but the bulk of our activities happen in the higher education institution space. And I think that it is important to mention that for a small license fee payable by universities, with no restrictions on the volume that may be reproduced, the licenses are granted to individual universities. The royalties that are collected are payable, are paid to publishers and authors where we represent authors directly or through publishers to own distribute. DARO's position on the Copyright Amendment Bill is as follows. What was the purpose of the bill? And we think that we have understood it to modernize the law for the internet era, to address the concerns expressed by creators of copyright works, as mentioned in consultations, especially with the President in the past. And the question for us is, does the bill achieve this? DARO's position is that we support the following in the bill. So the bill is not totally without merit, I must say. We hasten to end. So we support the introduction of the making available rights of copyright, communication to the public, and distribution. We also support the inclusion of the resale, what's called the resale of royalty right, which is properly known as the artist resale right, and we support that. We also urge Parliament to consider and support South Africa's accession to WIPO Copyright Treaty and the Marrakesh Treaty to benefit the disabled. We strongly urge and have asked repeatedly for the inclusion of a copyright levy which unfortunately has not been included in this bill, which we think will go a long way to alleviating some of the problems with income for the creative souls. We also think that the bill fails to meet the demands and expectations of creators as expressed to the president, as I mentioned before, in that the bill has changed fundamentally from being for the benefit to authors and creators to being about access to copyright works. Access in the sense of reproduction, extractions, and adaptations free of charge through the fair use and exceptions. The negatives are that there are the exceptions are too broad. The introduction of user rights is problematic for us. It is a concept not known in law anywhere in the world, and only is a construct of case law in Canada, the only place that such a right is referred to. The DALRO's position further is that DALRO, as an agency supported by voluntary mandates, we support the efficiency, transparency, and the reliability of collecting societies. We support the regulation of collecting agencies and societies to achieve this, provided that where a license from a registered collecting society exists, it must precedence over the exceptions. I shall give over to Mr. Maybeck to deal with the legal aspects specifically. But before he does so, I'd like to add that this presentation obviously supplements the written presentation that has already been submitted.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could supplement to what Mr. Sorovic... thank you, Madam Chair. If I can supplement to what Mr. Sorovic has just said about our written presentations, we've included both written submission made now in 2017, to which we attached our submission of 2015 in response to the draft copyright bill. The 2015 submission actually contained quite a lot of text that we suggested that the Department of Trade and Industry could adopt in legislation. So we have done our best there to provide some examples. On the screen there, you'll see I'm only going to address four issues here. I think many people are going to talk about other things, but these are the only ones that I'll touch on for the moment. The first one is where this all comes from. We've heard about submissions made to the President. We've also heard about the Copyright Review Commission report in 2011. Where there were recommendations made about regulating collecting societies, those were collecting societies in the music industry, where there were specific circumstances that applied. There was particular a collecting society for music that had gone bankrupt where the Commission made certain recommendations. And so DALRO also participated in that Commission's inquiry. Coming from that Commission was an implicit support for DALRO's higher education license, the only recommendation being to get work done so that DALRO can get mandates from authors direct and make distributions to authors as well as publishers, something which DALRO is taking very seriously indeed and will involve quite a lot of work to manage, but that is certainly what DALRO is looking at. On the issue of regulating of collecting societies, DALRO accepts that collecting societies should be recommended or should be regulated in principle, notwithstanding the fact that the Copyright Review Commission made only recommendations for the music industry. We think that is a good thing. There are certain points that need to be considered very carefully. The first one relates to the rule of registering one collecting society for each right under copyright. DALRO manages a number of rights under copyright, but there are no other collecting societies or copyright management agencies that manage these other rights. Dalro is the only one that does that. And as we'll see from later, there's considerable benefit in economies of scale of setting up systems to identify authors and artists and so forth so that distributions can be made to them. And some forms of licenses collect more money than others. So on economies of scale, it is very important that we look very carefully at the recommendation that Judge Fowler made there, because we do not think that he recommended that there should be only one company and one right. We think that what was recommended was that there could be one collecting society that manages a lot of rights as long as they don't manage in competition with each other. And that was a big issue with their report back in 2011. It's something that we're in the Netherlands, they've recently adopted legislation that could be interesting to look at in the future. As Mr. Sarobi said earlier, we would want these collecting societies or regulations to support the business of collecting societies. Mr. Sarobi suggested that licenses offered by registered collecting societies should overrule exceptions in given cases. And this is an approach that was adopted in certain exceptions in the United Kingdom in their copyright review not too many years ago. Ms. McGogo of SAMRO asked for an obligation on licensees of collecting society licenses to support them by giving information. All of these things we still need to see in this particular section on regulation. We would also need to reconsider membership and management issues because, again, we have the perpetual problem mentioned by everyone so far about users featuring there. Introducing users in collecting society decision-making will, for example, on things like tariffs and collections, will simply just create a stalemate. We need to revisit that quite substantially. Resale royalty right, or the artist's resale right, is something which Dalro supports. Dalro already supports visual artists in licensing their works for commercial uses. There's a tariff, there's a license in place. And so it is already geared to supporting the resale royalty rights, and we can make no bones about it. This is what we would like to propose to do. And here, specifically here, because the resale royalty right will be very costly to administer because you're going to be dealing with a large number of artists and craftsmen. These require databases to be kept up to date, staff to keep them up to date. It's far more complex than simply just dealing with publishers. So here is specifically a case where it would be beneficial if more than one right can relate to a registered collecting society.
You need to wrap up.
So, and Adoro is prepared to assist with drafting, with working on the legislation for you. The copyright levy has already been raised by Mr. Sarobi. I think for the sake of time, I'll not repeat it. Other than to say that the copyright levy is already implemented in many countries in Africa as well as around the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We do need to ask visitors. I'm just looking here. We have Delro, Samro, Milling. Is it Professor Flynn? Global Network on Copyright Users' Rights Firm. So if you could just stay there somewhere. I'm just looking. The two people right at the back, are you not with DTI? Could you just move, please? Able to secure members through Mr. Herman today. We've been able to ship someone to another day. Isn't that right, Mr. Herman? You're the book council, so that we don't run out of time. All right? And keep Fridays as is, and just to say Thursdays by an hour or so. So we hope that will be.
true privilege to be here. I would like to take this moment to recognize the youngest person in the room, which is my son, Aiden Flynn, who's sitting in the back and learning all about copyright. I'm happy to have him. So I'm here representing the Global Expert Network on Copyright, the one with the curly hair, poking his ceiling, rises about that far up. So I'm here, the organization which the staff has taken initiative to call EARN, but I'm not sure if we'll keep that or not, but it's we're the Global Expert Network on Copyright User Rights. So thank you for the acronym. That organization is a group of copyright academics, professors, and experts from around the world who come from 30 or 35 different countries. And we come around the purpose of providing research and technical assistance on the value of having open-ended copyright exceptions, like the Fair Use Clause in the United States, but sometimes called Fair Dealing Clauses in other places. And so I want to spend this time talking a little bit about the mechanics of open exceptions, what fair use means to some and differences with fair dealing, what some of our research is on the implications of adopting such an exception for South Africa, and open myself up to questions, of course. A couple just kind of, terminological issues that are floating around, and I'm happy to address these further in questions. So the issue of, copyright as property, I think constitutionally speaking, it is a property right, but copyright's genesis doesn't come from land law. It comes from franchise law. It comes from the 11th and 12th century in England when royal franchises were given. It's a monopoly. It's the right to be the only seller of a particular good for a public purpose. And that's an important history because those franchises in the common law were always surrounded by a public interest duty. The holder of that franchise had a duty to serve all on reasonable terms and conditions. And so those we've heard, some questions about, well, should there be reasonable pricing or reasonable conditions laws in the Act? There always have been, associated with copyright and patents and all other kinds of publicly given franchises. It's been suggested that something in the Act expropriates property, and I would say that, that constitutionally that's a very heavy term, right? That points you to Section 25.2 instead of 25.1 of the Constitution. Copyrights are, of course, granted by the state itself, and the state defines the bounds of those copyright terms, and according with Section 25.1 of the Constitution, the main requirement there is that dump be done through law of a general application. I don't see anything in the law that expropriates property, where the state is actually taking ownership of property, but that's what would be required to get you into Section 25.2. I'm happy to talk more about that. But let me get into, a little bit of the mechanics of fair use. So first, the words, the magic of U.S. law is not the words fair use as opposed to fair dealing. Actually, those two terms, use and dealing, are the same. They mean that exception, the general exception, which South Africa already has in Section 12, that exception applies to every possible right within the exception. So it's not an exception just for reproduction, or just for display, or just for communication, etc. The terms use and the terms dealing apply to all of those different rights. So in that sense, you can use the words fair use, or you can use the words fair dealing, and it will not change the meaning of that. What is novel about the U.S. example, and what the current bill does not have, the real magic words are those words such as. That allows the general exception to apply to any fair use or fair dealing of a copyrighted work, instead of only those purposes that are mentioned in the specific act. So what does the bill do? The 2017 bill elongates the list of purposes. So this is the current law, the current South African fair dealing exception. So you see that it authorizes any fair dealing. So fairness is the restraint. It's not any use, it's not any dealing, it's only one that is fair. But in addition, it says it must be only for the following purposes: research, private study, criticism, and review reporting of current events. The difference with the U.S. is it would say, no, any fair dealing is allowed, not only ones for those purposes. So the restraint comes in not listing the kinds of purposes that one can use, but rather in the definition of fairness itself. And so the law, the 27 bill, actually very usefully provides a new and very specific four-part test, the most crucial of which is saying that the use cannot substitute for the work of the original in the market. So that's really what we're hearing the creators come and say, please don't take away, you know, my ability to market my work. And fair use doesn't do that actually by definition. You must recall that this standard does come from the United States in the 1970s. And what we have accomplished in that time. I mean, global dominance in the entertainment industry, right? I mean, this doesn't take away your ability to profit from publications, from movies, etc. What does it do? It gives the ability to declare uses fair that are not listed for those specific purposes. So what might those be? I mean, if you think about these purposes here, you really don't have anything in the digital economy, the internet economy, right? And if you think of the way internet search works, so internet search literally copies the entire internet. The entire internet is literally protected by copyright. It's all expression that has been published in some form. So every web page, whether that be a blog or whether that whole movies or what have you, is copyright protected content. So if you want to search that content, if you want to send machines out to find out where your favorite European newspaper is, for instance, how does that machine know? It copies it into an index. You're searching a copy when you search. So what is it in the fair dealing right that gives you the ability to create a search mechanism? It's not for research, it's not for private study, it's not for criticism or review, it's not for the reporting of current events. How does language translation tools work? If I was to try to translate my speech right now into Zulu, which you can do in apps that are available on the internet today, how does that work? And the answer is that we send out machines that find instances where people are translating from one to another, and it copies those instances of copyright protected speech. And then it reissues that into a new form. It data mines that in order to find connections. There are tools out today that I saw Google present last week up in Johannesburg that will allow an app to take a picture of a bird and identify it. How does it do that? It puts machines out on the internet and it makes copies of every picture of a bird it can find on the internet. Millions and millions of copies of copyright protected photographs. What allows you to do that under the current act? So none of these new innovative uses of the internet take place in South Africa today. All of those apps are being made in the United States. Because those publishers and those innovators believe that the flexibility of the US Fair Use Clause, which is the word such as, not the words fair use, give it enough cover that if somebody was to make a complaint, it can defend itself. And it can defend itself even though the legislature in 1978, when they crafted the U.S. Fair Use Clause, wasn't thinking about the internet because it didn't exist. They weren't even thinking about the VCR because that didn't exist. But that was also held to be fair use.
Now, the idea that you have to litigate every fair use in order to enjoy it is absolutely false. So all those instances I've just named in which innovations are taking place that clearly make reproductions of copyrighted works have not been sued in the United States. The companies do them in the United States because they know if they do get sued, they won't clearly lose, because they don't have a rigid, inflexible copyright that says you must be one of only these purposes and only to survive. They know that at the end of the day, they can make an argument. And so if somebody comes, they can have that discussion. And if the lawsuit takes place, they can defend it. So probably the biggest of these, and I would encourage you to think about it, is the Google Books case. So the Google Books case, Google went into universities and copied every single book in the universities. But they copy it for research purposes. So you can't get full copies of those books on Google Books. What you can do is research them. You can index them. You can search and find quotations. So it's a research tool. It's using those books for a completely different purpose, serving a different kind of audience that never existed before. And you can do that because the courts ultimately, the publishers did sue on that one, and Google defended themselves, and the courts ultimately held it's permissible. It's permissible because it's a transformative use that uses that good for a different purpose that wasn't being provided by the original. And that's the kind of flexibility that it has. I actually happen to know, because I visited on my last trip, that downstairs in this building in your library, you have massive book copying machines with the ability to scan every book in your parliamentary library. And they're not doing it. They could, but they're not sure what legal authority they have to make those books available to you and to your staff and to the public of South Africa. So you can do things that overcome these problems, and you can do it in ways that don't sacrifice the interests of the author. And that's the key point at which Tobias Schoenwetter spoke about. That point that in order to be fair, you can't substitute for the work of the author in the market. So that means a school can't just copy textbooks and give them for their students. A pirate can't just copy music or movies and put them on the internet. All those things are still piracy. There's still piracy in the United States, and there'll still be piracy in South Africa even after you adopt fair use. But what you will do when you adopt fair use, by which I mean not the terms fair use, but rather the terms such as opening up the purposes for which you can use content, you will be giving a green light for innovators to think about and do new things. For the Shuttleworths of your country to not move to the United States when they want to develop the next huge program, right? For the Elon Musks to not move to the United States when they want to continue their industry. If you want to truly enable innovation and entrepreneurship, then you need to truly study what the enabling requirements for that entrepreneurship are. And tomorrow or Friday, you're going to hear the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the other American speaking to you. And they're going to tell you to not adopt U.S. law on this issue. I urge you to think critically about why it's in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce interest to ask you to not adopt U.S. law. Or why our own U.S. trade representative, if they were here, would urge you to not adopt U.S. law. Or why, if you ask the U.S. Department of State on this issue, they would urge you not to adopt that rule. And the reason is because it gives us a competitive advantage. We like the fact, I was in Australia earlier this year, and there were some Google representatives there, and they said, you know, we have 1,000 software engineers in Australia, and whenever they come up with a machine learning idea, we move them to San Francisco. And whenever they come up with an artificial intelligence idea, we move them to San Francisco. We like that. It's in the United States' interest to be the best place for innovation and entrepreneurship in the world. And if you want to be the best place for entrepreneurship and innovation in the world, you should consider very carefully copying that aspect that the innovators say is most important to their work. You can also listen to the Motion Picture Association that has a quote, and I can provide it with you, which says, we use fair use every day. Our movies use fair use. Our documentaries use fair use. What right is there, you know, for Mark, who's sitting back there, to capture audiovisual work in the backgrounds of his documentaries? And the answer in current South African law is there isn't. Your law doesn't provide for that. If it had fair use, it would. What law is there that allows filmmakers to format shift copies of things that they've accumulated for their research from one format to another or to use the cloud? Nothing currently. The current bill would include format shifting in one of its exceptions, and you can do so explicitly. But you can also future-proof your law by making those purposes open for which you can apply in the future. I think my slides, I think, have gone around, and I don't need to go all the way through them, but I'll just summarize by saying we've been doing economic research on this. We've accumulated a database of 20 different countries over 40 years, and we've measured whether countries do better that have more open copyright exceptions than ones that have more closed copyright exceptions. And the answer is yes, that countries attract more research and development. They output more in their high technology as well as their creative sectors. So what we found in going through that data is there's a general trend towards what I've been calling openness. That's the such as, not whether they use the terms fair use, whether that be in educational exceptions or in quotation exceptions, etc. We as a world are moving towards more open exceptions, but the wealthier countries are moving faster than the poorer ones. There's a reason for that. These kind of industries that I've named tend to be in wealthier countries, and so they have more of a political voice. But you can learn from them. We've looked at whether you find more research and development expenditures, for instance, in software firms, and we find that you do. This is in fair use countries. So there's 8 countries around the world that have what we would call fair use systems, which is an open general exception. 2 of them just call it fair dealing, actually, thus the indeterminacy of that term. Singapore and Malaysia both call it fair dealing. But they both have those words either such as or including that provides an open list of exceptions, open list of purposes. We've done some economic regressions, which mean that you control the numbers for things like firm size and GDP of the country in which those firms are in. And we find that those numbers hold up, that there are statistically significant relationships between more open copyright environments and research and development in the software and computer industries. And importantly, we also find that publishing does better, that entertainment industry does better, that broadcasting does better, that those different copyright-intensive industries do better in countries with fair use, and also in the countries with more open limitations and exceptions environment, controlled for GDP per capita of the country, firm size, etc. So this is just to say that there is empirical evidence that shows that your high technology firms will benefit, and that your creative industry firms will not be harmed. I'm ready to close right now, because that's basically the end point. I think this is the opportunity for you to present a win-win situation, to put something in your law that will clearly benefit sectors of your economy and clearly not harm others. And I invite you to try to attract and interrogate anybody who claims to have empirical evidence to the contrary, because we think this is supported by research. Thank you very much.
Now, members, you have the opportunity now to ask questions across indicate who you are asking the question of. Summers, Dalrow, Professor Flynn, or all three. Is that all right? We will run two rounds. So let's start off with 3 minutes for each person and see how far we go. Can I see by show of hands a maximum of 3 minutes each? Honourable Esther Hazen. Right. Honourable MacPherson. Did I see another hand up? Not just yet. Do go ahead. Honourable Esther Hazen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Talking of Dalrow, I understand that this is really wrong. Dalrow says that I actually agree. I agree with a lot of the points. The arrangement of the bill actually makes better reading this time, but the poor quality of legislative drafting that went into the bill is still not up to standard, and I agree with some of the points that were said. The bill failed to accord to the IP law's understanding of authors and owners. Authors are individuals who create IP and usually the owners as well, and I think that the contracts and employment conditions that can have the effect to that owner is distinct from the author, and that Dr. Schoenwetter could maybe agree with that as universities and academics. The bill talks of users and producers as well as authors and owners, and users and producers have no meaning in South African IP law. I also I mentioned that the bill fails to accord to South African IP laws understanding, and the bill fails to deal with the lack of compliance, and we agree to that. Flynn was on the line. We also, you know, I agree, we strive to be to bear entrepreneurship, and that's all over. The better protection you get from that as well. One of your fellow countrymen, Joe Morrison, once said, you don't care, he said, why would we want to register the Doors music? The more groupies that are here, the better, or that's how he values these things. But that doesn't work, unfortunately, that anymore. We need protection, and we need for our entrepreneurship as well. The scope of copyright protection has been specified not to include ideas and methods of operation and mathematical concepts. In the case of computer program, interface specifications have been excluded, which also, to me, is a very sad case, Madam Chair. And we have some of the best laws and policies in the world and in this country, and by failing to enforce them, or the political will to do so, will fail all of us as South Africans. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Esther Hazen, Honourable MacPherson.
Time as copyright as property, as
the ownership of what you have created. I'm not sure that the discussions are meeting their full intended purpose. And it's why I've asked, and I haven't got an answer to my question, as how Section 25 of the Constitution intersects with this bill, and why the bill is not clear on those particular provisions. But what I would like to just have some further explanation on is with regards to collecting societies being the best place to deal with orphan works. How do you envisage that to take place? Who regulates that? Who bears the cost of going to actively seek out those potential owners of those orphaned works? You stated, or your colleague stated, with regard to the costs of litigation, and I agree that it is very expensive, and that if you are a starting out artist, that you may not have access to do so. Has your association assisted with any litigation, and what have those cases been, and what have the outcomes for those cases been? With regard to Dalro, I think the story from Ms. Mokwepi was inspiring, and I think to get to where you have got to today, with very little support or assistance or the protection that you deserve, it is admirable, and I want to salute you for that, and I hope that you will continue to publish your works and continue to tell the story that I think that South Africans need to hear. So I want to encourage you in that respect, and hopefully you will get protection and the due reward that you deserve in time. And I think that your statement, and I'd like to quote you on it, that we must not kill the soul of African authors, is important for us to take cognizance of, and I hope that my fellow committee members will do so. But with respect to one of your negatives that your colleague was explaining, with respect to the introduction of users' rights and it being problematic, I just want some further explanation on that, and if you could expand on that. And why you believe that terminology is problematic. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable McPherson. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just going to talk to, I think it's Professor Sean Flynn. I'm not sure if it's Professor or Doctor or Mr. Anyway, on your input, you were talking about fair use in the digital environment. And I just want to know, what are your thoughts when it's outside of the digital environment? So it's, a hard copy, as it were. I mean, how does that take away from all the good positive things you said about fair use and how beneficial it is? And secondly, I just want you to repeat what you said about the property clause in the constitutionality of the property clause, whether it relates to this legislation. Just repeat what you said, because I think some of the members weren't in the room when you talked to that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. I will come back to you in a minute, Honourable Yesterhazen. Honourable Montage.
I just wanted Albert to explain whether they were saying, if I heard them correctly, that they want a collecting society for each sector of yourself. Because you said it's a lot of it, you can't make follow-ups on the collection. Do you want more one for each sector, or what did you mean?
Thank you, Honourable Mantash. Just to follow up there to complete your point, Honourable Yesterhazen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. specifically states that a published work will brought it to all students. And for me, that's a very big shortfall in the bill. The textbook that cannot be obtained for a reasonable price can now be wholly reproduced without permission. And who determines what's a reasonable price? And this is a big fault in me.
Thank you, Honourable Esther Hazen. I just want to, I think it was Delro who spoke about the copyright issue or levy. Delro? And then indicating that, well, you know, we don't see that anywhere, etc. We're surprised and disappointed. Tell us a little bit more about your disappointment and what motivates it. And although I do not wish you to respond now, DTI, this is not the time, but in respect of the clauses in the bill that undermine some row members' rights, do you remember the reference to that, Clause 4C? It would be appreciated if you would look at that so that you are prepared for an effective response there in relationship to the sister bill, I think it's performers, etc., and whether or not, although it's not covered in the copyright, whether it's not effectively covered in the sister bill. All right, would you just look at that, but not respond right now, all right? Now, members, you've got the opportunity. Perhaps we should take them in the order in which they came, or I see Professor Flynn, you're already there. You had one or two questions, didn't you? And then if you would make space for Delro. Okay, thank you. And Sumro.
Great, thank you very much. I think there's several of those that I would like to respond to. Let me take the property clause maybe first, because that's come up a couple of times, and I'm not sure, Member McPherson, you may not have been around when I was around. So first, just qualification side. I'm not a South African lawyer, but I got my grounding here working for a clerk for Justice Chaskelson in the year 2000, and I taught a course on constitutional law at the University of Witwatersrand, and I've been coming back and forth to South Africa for the last 15 years or so. I also worked in the Department of Land Affairs for Jeff Budlander for a time. So the property clause is something I'm familiar with. And so Section 25 has two different terms that are very important. So Section 25.1 talks about deprivations, and Section 25.2 talks about expropriations. And Professor Schoenwetter and I last night, you know, spent a little bit of time brushing up on that after reading some of the opinions. And I think Matthew Chaskelson's book on constitutional law has a section on property law that's very informative. Now, those clauses were drafted very specifically in response to an innovation in the U.S. law under the conservative Supreme Court that began inventing a doctrine called regulatory takings. And the idea was that at some point, the regulation of somebody's property law, which before that period was seen as completely a constitutional prerogative of the state, with no constitutional scrutiny whatsoever, that if a regulation was to completely sap the value of that property law, that one could bring an expropriation case against the state and receive compensation for that. So in response to that kind of doctrine, the South African drafters distinguished between a deprivation of property, which may include some kind of diminution of value, and an expropriation of property in which title to the property actually does transfer to the state. And it's only in expropriation case that compensation is required. In a deprivation case, the only norms that apply is that it must be non-arbitrary, so there must be a reasonable relationship between the means and the ends of the law, and that it be done by law of general application. So that is what you all are debating and creating a record for right now. You know, what is the public interest? What's the links between the public interest means you're trying to protect and the regulation of property, of which copyright is one, which is the means for that? And you're doing it through parliamentary law, which by definition is a law of general application. And so Chaskos and Stries would say, actually, in a deprivation case, when you meet those requirements, there's no need to actually go on through an additional kind of Section 26 limitations analysis. And that's an academic point, hasn't been tested in the courts. But I think what's fairly clear is that, so first of all, every regulation of property regulates the value of that property in some means. And so if you had this kind of idea that every regulation of property that diminished its value or regulated from having the most highest profits valuable was somehow an expropriation, you'd have just an incredible number of constitutional claims, right? So that was the reason that drafting was separated. So I think you're on pretty clear constitutional footing of what you're doing, of kind of limiting the scope of copyrights, which are state-granted rights to begin with. That's also why I raise, it's important if one is going through history to notice that this idea of calling copyright a property right is actually a 20th century innovation. And it was a footnote as a way to kind of lump together trademarks and patents and copyrights and all these things into kind of an idea of intellectual property. But that idea is contested today. There are some law professors around the world that refuse to name intellectual property as such and say, no, it's just a series of doctrines, it's copyright doctrines, patent doctrine, whatever. But I think it's settled that these kind of rights, because they create expectations, are in a modern sense property. Not property like land, but property like entitlements. And those entitlements must go through a due process protection in order to limit those entitlements. So, you know, if you want a footnote for that part of your paper, it's Charles Reich, right? The article called The New Property, and talking about why, for instance, welfare benefits could be considered property, because people have a reasonable expectation to their continuation. And that doesn't mean you can't limit it. It just means that you have to go through due process concerns in order to limit it. And that applies to copyright too, but there's nothing in the legislation.
You had 6 minutes. Do you think you've...
Apologies. Yeah, no, That's I think the point there. On orphan works, I would just footnote that, you know, a simpler way to deal with orphan works, which is the way that the U.S. deals with it, is you just include it within fair use. You don't necessarily need a huge organizational structure for that. On the term user rights, so there are user rights. So you have within your law now the right to quote material. And a copyright owner cannot prevent you from quoting that material. So that is a right that cannot be prevented. And there are cases in the United States, the Lenz case, that's actually held that that's an affirmative right, the fair use right, that can be litigated against content owners that take your material down without considering the fair use of that right. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Flynn. And then perhaps Delru, if you want to come across, please, into the front position. Just swap places, it's much quicker.
Can we do it from here? Oh, you want to?
That's right. And you just swap.
Madam Chair, I think I just want to respond to the question about users' rights. The statement has been made that the use of that term is causing a lot of confusion, a lot of contradictions. We have heard from a number of people that users create, and that is why there should be users' rights to enable them to create. But when they create an original literary work, original artistic work, they become authors. So if that is what is, and to the extent that that is what is wanted to be covered, the term users actually does not need to appear here at all. Insofar as you're speaking about users who are people who reproduce works or broadcast works or perform works, where the normal rule of copyright is that they require the permission of the owner, when you talk about users in that sense, then I must point out that, so far as I know, there's no legislation in the world that has a section in it dealing with users' rights in relation to copyright.
Now, certainly there are consumer rights, and South Africa's got very advanced consumer legislation, and that can play a role here. But there's nothing in any copyright legislation in the world that talks about users' rights. As you would have seen from the Dalrow slide, it comes from case law in Canada. The term comes from case law in Canada, where the Supreme Court in Canada held that exceptions and limitations should be seen as users' rights. But it's certainly not the law of South Africa.
I think there was a question about the one society per right, and we hold that the bill misrepresents what the Copyright Review Commission recommended to have non-competing societies in the management of a right, but that has morphed now into reading to be that a society is only allowed to handle one right and no more, and that should be corrected. So we do not want, we're not advocating for a one society per right at all. We're actually advocating for the opposite. Oh, there was also a question about from the chair about the levy. I wasn't sure. The chair just said that say a little more about that. So I'm not sure. It's a very open-ended question. But we also hold that in the age of the internet and technology and digitization, it is very easy to abuse copyrighted works, and civilized societies have recognized that and granted authors of copyrighted works a compensation through the levy, because the policing of the internet and digital spaces is that much more difficult, and we urge and had hoped to see the levy in the current bill, and it is not there at all.
No, thank you. Of course, there are occasions when a reference may be made, but the detail is provided in secondary legislation, which you know is what you would call regulation. But it is legislation. The reason for that is perhaps it's much easier to change a regulation. You don't have to come necessarily back to Parliament, and there may be a need for a financial change. But we're not considering the bill just yet, so that's why we need to take greater account of what you are saying. And perhaps you can send us another page, just explanatory issue on the levy. All right. Thank you. All right, now you may stay there, yes, because you're in the front, and that is Sumrow.
It's still Dalra. I just want to answer the question about the textbooks. That's section 13B of the Act, which allows you to reproduce an entire textbook which is either out of print, not available in territory, or where there's no reasonable price for the charge of the purchase of that textbook. We find it rather problematic because in a world where there is licensing, and the licensing restricts you to only one chapter of a book so as not to compete with purchases, should that book not be available in territory, and considering the number of books that we do import from overseas, technically they're not available in territory until we import them. You do stand the danger of people using that to say, well, I'm going to copy, why should I license a single chapter when I can simply copy the entire book without a license? The other problem, of course, is that should it be an orphan work, and in most cases orphan works are out of print books, an orphan work you need to advertise in the Government Gazette 3 times before you may reproduce, and you need permission from the publisher, sorry, from the government. You may simply then, as a user, decide that it is simply an out-of-print book rather than an orphan work. And the reason why orphan works probably do not belong under fair use is because of this particular act that says that the minute an author dies, the work becomes technically an orphan work until the heirs come forward to claim their rights back again. And those are issues that do make it problematic. Current?
Have they changed it? Okay.
No, they've changed that, sorry.
Yes.
Okay. So the point is just that it does leave the onus on the user to make those decisions and the onus on the author or rights holder to challenge that use, and that becomes very difficult to manage.
Thank you very much. Is that, are you completed, Delmer? Yes, Sandra.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Honourable Matheson, thank you for the questions. Just to make a comment on the Section 25 intersection with the legislation, I think I just want to also just make it clear that our biggest issue regarding the expropriation, what we do in terms of expropriation, is not with the fair use clause. It is with the clause 3 of the bill, which says that when a work is commissioned by the state broadcaster, for example, where in the current situation the copyright, that commissioned payment is for the labor of creating, the copyright remains with the author, the composer. With the bill, there's an automatic transfer of copyright. And this is where I'm saying the 80 to 90 million rand annually currently earned by commissioned writers only on public performance will suddenly stop. And that is definitely an issue around expropriation. And you're absolutely right. When you're talking about land, for example, compensation for expropriation is a big deal. But now it is actually very worrying when the recipients of that expropriation are, you know, your previously disadvantaged people, actually. That is when suddenly, you know, the question of why is it that we're not compensating them for that expropriation. So it is actually very unfair. The second issue you mentioned is around orphan works and why we feel that we're best placed to administer orphan works or works with undocumented works. So collection societies have the infrastructure. We also have a very, very large database. SAVLA is a very large database, both locally and internationally. We need to obviously work better to ensure, you know, together with the users and with the regulators, as far as I'm concerned, to make sure that the amount of orphan works is lessened. So currently what we do is we actually have a team at SAMRO that sits before and after every single distribution, goes through all the documentation around works that do not have owners, and we have supplementary distributions whenever we are able to find those owners. And I mean, that is also a relationship with our members who release music, for example, but don't notify us of their new releases. So they may have been a member and may have earned before, but we don't have their latest data. And I think also, to be quite fair and honest, we also need to carry on working to improve our processes. But we are best placed, and we do, and this is where we are not in principle against regulation that does hold us accountable for things like that. But in terms of the infrastructure and processes, and most importantly the databases, we have access to that as opposed to anyone else. Around litigation costs, what SAMRO currently has an alternative dispute resolution process where whenever there's a dispute in terms of who owns music or if there's been an issue around ownership of music that has been sold or broadcast, we actually have our legal department go through a process which we try and hope to resolve issues before they go to court. But I'd like to actually bring in my colleague here, because where we find that we have deadlocks, where we cannot for whatever reason find resolution, the next step is to go to court. And the number of sitting cases that don't go to court because of financial constraints which are in the waiting, on the waiting list to get into court and be heard, there's no resolution. And I think this is the actual critical issue, that we have issues around the means of litigating and the timeline. Because whilst we're still waiting to see who owns this music, the song is busy earning. And because we, as SAMRO, we don't know who, we haven't been able to find out who actually owns it, the money is sitting also in what we would then call orphan works, but we have no way of resolving. Can I bring in Melissa here to maybe just talk about that legal process and how you have found where the cases have to actually escalate and go to the High Court, what the issues are.
Indeed, thank you, Nathando.
Yes, Honourable Chair, we have mentioned before that, in fact, when Dr. Khumalo was introducing us, she did say Ms. Melissa Moore, who's head of legal at SAMRO, is with us.
They just want to space for me over there. I echo what Notando has said, but it doesn't only deal with conflicting claims, it also deals with infringements. So this is where users just point blank refuse to take out a license with us and they infringe on a daily basis. This is a very cumbersome process, number one. You have to proceed to court. Our internal processes don't accommodate that. And I think what's important to note, and you asked about costs, is that we are a membership-based organization. So we are directly accountable to our members for every single thing that we do. And the costs of this litigation, not to mention the delays, actually come from the purses of each and every single member. So it reduces their earning capacity substantially, and not to mention the fact that it's difficult for us to take up these enforcement issues when it's the creator against the whole world who could potentially infringe at their discretion.
Is that it? Thank you. Yeah, thank you. I think that covers your three questions. Thank you very much, Honourable Chair.
Right. It would appear as if members have received the responses to the comments and questions. If you have any other comments and questions, we've got 4 minutes left. So just a few seconds, maybe 30 seconds to a minute, anyone? Honourable Eerstehaven, Honourable Mabuyane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just maybe on Dara and I think that this will in any way will violate the rights of the people that you represent in this country.
Right. Honourable Mabuyane.
Mr. Chair, one clarity. I'm not so sure in terms of the user's benefit vis-a-vis the creator's benefit. You go there, you've got users' access and also creator's rights. So I'm not so sure whether we can be able to be clarified on this one, because the initial speaker told us that there's an author and there's an owner. So we want to grasp with this issue so that we get clarity as to how is it properly managed and what is it that must be reflected on the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ryan, can you respond to that, please? Just two questions. Who wants to take that on yourself, somewhere?
Thank you. The question of will the rights of our members be violated? Yes, we definitely feel that is the case. The IP consultative framework specifically articulates in the introduction that the copyright and intellectual property rights are property rights as enshrined in the Constitution. And any right in the Constitution has to be limited in very specific and given mannerisms or given steps. And there are provisions here that do not follow those constitutional steps. So that we are of the view of that. So regarding users' interests versus the copyright owner's rights, you just want us to further articulate what the difference is? So if we start with the copyright holder, the creator, as I've just given the example now, that if intellectual property is within what is meant by property, it is so the copyright owner has a bill of rights to his property, right? A user cannot have a right to that property. That property is not the fruits of his labor. However, it is in the public interest that if I create something that is useful to society, that I should not be the only person to have access to it at all. I mean, if it's something that will benefit listeners, scholars, etc. So the user's interest is to say that the public should have access to that property that I have, as the creator, have a bill of rights to. What we're saying, though, that interest has to be within a framework that allows the creator to carry on creating. Because if my creation is going to be totally unrecognized as belonging to me, or that I have exclusive rights with, I want to carry on creating. So in terms of, and that's where the user's interest in terms of owner versus author, the author is the person who actually is the first owner. The author is the first owner. A secondary owner is when I, as the author, assign my rights by contract and say that I'm giving you my copyright. You become the secondary owner. Then this is now a distinction between myself as the author and you as the owner. And we're saying that, I mean, for now in the bill, there's specific instances where I'm the author and the owner, but without signing a contract or without assigning my ownership to you, it's automatically taken, and that is problematic. I don't know if there's anything, if I'm missing something in terms of.
Perhaps what one can just add there is that, as Ms. Mngogo says, the author is the authorship does not change. Someone who's created something will always be the creator of that specific work. However, they can, by contract, assign that the ownership to a third party, somebody else. The user, however, it is our contention that the user can never be an owner. And in this bill, the user is often equated with an author or an owner, and is even allowed to earn royalties as a user, and that we think is contradictory. Where a user has, as an example has been given, utilizes transformatively somebody else's work to create a new work, that user can then be regarded as an author of a new work. They can't earn royalties as a user. They can, however, be recognized as an author themselves because they've created something new. And I don't think anyone has a problem with that.
Right. Thank you very much. Members, I know that we would have liked further engagement, but we're not over. We've only just started dipping our toes in the water. And those of you who are contributing here and assisting us in ensuring we bring about robust legislation, thank you very much. I know you would have all liked more time. But whatever it is you'd like to explain or clarify more, put it in writing. And members, you know you can do the same. All right. Now, I'm going to hand over for a few moments to Mr. Hermans, one of the committee secretaries, to clarify certain administrative arrangements today and for the rest of the week, which does affect stakeholders. Thank you.
Based on the committee's decision today to start at 8:30 on Thursday, a new program will be forwarded to all stakeholders that's coming on Thursday. And then you please need to check the time, because the time may have changed. Also, there have been some stakeholders who has not been allocated a slot. They may also be allocated on Thursday an additional slot, so they please need to check. Also, it's important, if a stakeholder has made any changes to their PowerPoint presentation, to forward it to us as soon as possible, because it creates a problem on the day, because we're not sitting next to a copy machine around the corner. And members would like to have the actual PowerPoint presentation that the stakeholder will present. Also, the African Book Development Council, who was allocated for today, they have been shifted to Friday. They've agreed that they will come on Friday, so we made accommodation for that. The time on Thursday is 8:30 till 7 o'clock. The time on Friday is 8:30 till 7:30. 5:30. Okay? But I beg of stakeholders to please submit any changes timely to us, to any PowerPoint presentation that they may wish to make. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hermans. And we are now going to break for lunch, and we're starting at 2 o'clock sharp. Please be back.
back at 2:05. For those of you who have different watches to mine, it is now 1:20 on mine. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.